Thanks, Brother Joe. Let me just share my screen. One moment, brothers and sisters. Hopefully you all can see the screen now and hear me clearly. So, thanks again, Brother Joe, and good evening, everybody. Tonight we're going to look, as we've seen and read, Zechariah chapter 4. By way of introduction, just a few notes. The talk this evening is not going to be a verse-by-verse study, but rather a thematic study. So we're not necessarily going to go in order of the verses that they are before us in the book, in the Bible. All the quotes we're going to refer to are included in the presentation. So if you just want to concentrate on the quotes rather than looking at that, by all means do so. They will be there for you. So I thought we'd just have a very brief recap of the visions so far, so we can see where we are in these visions. Then we'll have an overview of this fifth vision that we've read. We'll look at the context of the vision, how it fits in with those verses and chapters that have gone before, and how it fits in with the current context, and in the context of where we are as a brotherhood as well. We're going to look at some of the symbols, the stone, the lampstand, the planet, etc. So it will better enable us to understand this prophecy of Zechariah, but also other parts of Scripture, particularly Revelation, where these themes are also portrayed. And then as we're going through, and at the end as well, we'll sort of have a glimpse of the vision of the age to come when we pull all these thoughts together. So as a recap then, we've seen from the book and from Haggai as well that the 70 years of captivity of the Jews in Babylon has ended, and God has remembered his people. And we see those thoughts in the first vision of the man, the horses, and the myrtle trees. Babylon has been defeated by Cyrus the Persian, and we see that depicted in the four horns and the four carpenters. And Cyrus was a great supporter of the Jews returning back to Jerusalem. And we see in the previous vision of the man with the line, how the Jerusalem was measured out, ready for the inhabitants to return and for the building of the great temple there. And the iniquity of the nation had been removed. God had forgiven their sins and given them a new start. And we see that depicted in the removal of Joshua's filthy rags. So thanks to the brethren that have gone before, Brother David and Brother Tim for giving these thoughts. So a bit of a timeline then, brothers and sisters. We see in 536 BC that Cyrus gave his great decree that the people could go back. And we see the reference on the right-hand side there of Ezra. In the same year, the seventh month, the altar was built. And in the following year, BC 535, the foundation of the temple was laid. And that leads us up to the prophecy of Zechariah. So what do we see in the vision? Just have a quick look at the way the book is broken down, or the chapter's broken down, rather. Zechariah, having been awoken from sleep by an angel, sees a lampstand and a bowl placed between two olive trees. These trees are connected to the lampstand by two branches and two pipes, and they're all golden, which is significant. That's verses 2-4. Zechariah, looking at this vision, asks the angel what this means in verse 4, but he doesn't get an answer. Rather, he gets an explanation of what he's going to be told, is that the work of Zerubbabel is going to be involved in the rebuilding of the temple in verses 6-10. And then finally, Zechariah is persistent and asks the angel again regarding what the lampstand means in the verses 11-12. And then finally, Zechariah gets an answer to his questions in verse 14 of the chapter. So that's a brief overview of what Zechariah saw and what we've read. We can see Zechariah had questions, and no doubt we've got questions. I know when I was looking at the talk, I had a lot of questions. But hopefully I've got some answers for you this evening. What is the context of the vision then is one of the questions that came to my mind. And what's the meaning of this peculiar lampstand that we see between the olive trees, unlike any of the lampstand we see portrayed in the scriptures? And what's the significance of Zerubbabel in the vision? And what are the primary and secondary fulfillments of the prophecy referenced by the David comments as he gave us the first talk in the series? And importantly for us, I think, what bearing does this prophecy have on you and me as we're living today before the Lord returns? So there's some of the questions I had for myself. And so we'll go through the talk, and hopefully I'll address some of those questions. So what's the context? Well, in this chapter, the temple we see was to be rebuilt in Jerusalem. And the point of it was that this was to be a witness to the world. God had cast off his people, so the world thought, for 70 years, but he's brought them back now. So they were to be a light to the world as it then was. And that light is represented, I believe, by the lampstand, this peculiar lampstand. And we see in Psalm 119, words we're familiar with, aren't we? That the entrance of thy words giveth light. It giveth understanding unto the simple. And the aim of the whole purpose of Israel was to be a light stand to the people around them, that they would see, look at the laws that they had and the words from God, and see that this was a righteous God and was a God of the living and not of the God of the dead, the gods of wood and stone of the nations around them. And Isaiah is very useful when we're looking at these prophecies, because it gives a lot of visions and thoughts towards Jerusalem in the future. And in the future, in this case, being at the time of Zechariah and Zerubbabel. We just read the words in Isaiah 62. For Zion's sake will I not hold my peace, and for Jerusalem's sake I will not rest, until the righteousness thereof go forth as brightness, and the salvation thereof as a lamp that burneth. And this is the point, that the Gentiles shall see thy righteousness, and all the kings thy glory. And they would have witnessed that when the temple was finally rebuilt in all its glory as it then was. So when we think about the temple was built that it might house many things, but particularly it was built, wasn't it, to house the lampstand in the holy place. So we're going to consider first the vision relating to the temple rebuilding, and then we'll consider the lampstand and the olive trees. So that's the order of sequence that we're going to deal with it tonight, brothers and sisters. So the foundation of the temple, we read from Ezra, these words in Ezra 5, verse 16. Then came Sheshbazzar and laid the foundation of the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. And since that time, even until now, it hath been in building, and yet it is not yet finished. Hence the prophecy now that the building would be finished. But Sheshbazzar is the Persian name for Zerubbabel, who we see featured in this chapter for the first time in this prophecy. So the timeline then was, we've seen that the foundation around the temple was laid in the second year of Cyrus, but it was left derelict, as it were, between 535 to 520, approximately 16 years if we take it sometime between 535 and sometime in the year BC 520. So it was laid derelict, it was laid waste, wasn't it? Because of the opposition of the enemies of the Jews around them in the land. And Haggai has this to say, that thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, this people say, the time is not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. So it was over 15 years they'd in effect been saying that, and God's purpose with the people had not yet been fulfilled because of their intransigence, perhaps. They'd all built houses for themselves, but the house of God was laid to rest, as it were, or the foundations were. But in Ezra 6, verse 14, we see the introduction of Zechariah now, that this was to be encouragement to the people. They'd left the temple building, but now through the words of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo, they would prosper, as Ezra 6, verse 14 tells us. And they did, because they finished the house according to the commandment of the God of Israel, through the commandment of Cyrus and Darius and Artaxerxes, king of Persia. So we see the purpose being worked out through Zechariah now, and he's now encouraging the people through Zerubbabel to complete the work of building. And so continuing in the timeline, we see it was the sixth month of the second year of Darius that Haggai begins his ministry, the eighth month of the same year, Zechariah begins his ministry, and we see in Zechariah chapter 1, verse 7, that the visions were also in that second year of Darius in the 11th month. That gives a bit of context, perhaps, of where we are in the historical account. So what then of Zerubbabel? Just a few moments to think about him. His name means descended from Babylon, and clearly that's where he'd come from, or say what he'd been for the last 70 years. He's known as the son of Shealtiel in the references there in Ezra and Nehemiah and Haggai. But we see he's also called the son of Padiah, the brother of Shealtiel in First Chronicles, and that might seem a bit of contradiction. we'll talk about that in a few seconds. But we see is all Zerubbabel was also mentioned in the genealogies noted in Matthew and also in Luke, called Zerubbabel. So what then, was he the son of Shealtiel or was he the son of Pedaiah? And this one commentator put forward this suggestion. He said that Shealtiel died without any male descendants, leaving his wife a widow. And after his death, his second brother Pedaiah fulfilled the levirate duty and begat in his marriage with his sister-in-law, he begat Zerubbabel, who is now regarded in all that relates to the laws of heritage as Shealtiel's son. So that perhaps clears up the discrepancy that many think in the scriptures are the contradictions, but it would appear that that's not the case, as we would expect from the God of truth. So Zerubbabel in Babylon, he was appointed by Cyrus, whose name was Sheshbazzar, as we see in Ezra 5, verse 14. He was made governor of the Jews, and he was the one tasked to bring all the vessels of the temple and the large sum of money to help him and his fellows go back to Jerusalem and establish the temple in Jerusalem. When he was in Jerusalem, we find he built the altar of God. He laid the foundation of God. He was there instrumental in completing the house of God. And finally, we read in Nehemiah that he also restored the divisions of the priests and the Levites that David had set up and put them in their courses and ordered their singing, etc. And Zerubbabel was instrumental in reinstating that in the new temple. So let's go into the prophecy then. Zechariah 4, verse 7. God says to Zechariah, "Who art thou, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel, thou shalt become a plain." So Zechariah has seen, if you like, in vision, a mountain before Zerubbabel. But it should become a plain, it should be destroyed. So who was that mountain? Well, firstly, it was Babylon, wasn't it? The people were brought out of Babylon. As Jeremiah said, "Behold, I'm against thee, O destroying mountain, saith the Lord." And that prophecy came true. But the mountain now was the people surrounding Jerusalem that were putting up such a fight against the Jews to stop them building this temple. They were fearful of the Jews and their presence. So this for the people was the great mountain. But before Zerubbabel, it would be destroyed. And so we see in Ezra 4, we get the context, that the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah and troubled them in building, and hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia, which we saw in the timeline, was in the second year of his reign. So the mountain was to be overcome, it was to be destroyed, it was to be leveled, to be made plain, as the scripture said. And then this would allow then the building of the temple. So we see in the verses 7-9 of this chapter that he shall bring forth the headstone thereof with shoutings. And in verse 9, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation, and I think it's related to the foundation stone, as we saw in the earlier verse in Ezra. He have laid the foundation stone, this house, his hands shall also finish it. So we see that we get to understand the foundation stone and also the headstone. When we look at the words for stone and headstone, the word for stone is not any particular stone that you might find on the ground. It means a stone for building. It's been shaped, it's been purposely built to build, and in this case, to be the foundation stone of the temple. And the headstone, as Twott says there, he says, this is the topmost stone, the headstone, as we find in the scriptures. It's interesting. This is the only occurrence of this particular word in the use of it. So it's quite significant that we've got the headstone and we've got the foundation stone. And this conjures up all sorts of thoughts in our mind, doesn't it? And again, the words of Isaiah came to my mind, where he says, "Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I lay in Zion for a foundation, a stone, a tried stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation. He that believeth shall not make haste." And that was the spirit of Zerubbabel, wasn't it? He came in that spirit of Isaiah to lay this precious foundation stone. But Isaiah continues in the same language that's picked up in Zechariah. He speaks about judgment also will I lay to the line and righteousness to the plummet, expressions we find here in Zechariah. Now the word plummet there in Isaiah is a different word to what we find in Zechariah, but nonetheless, it's the same idea. And we can see, can't we, that as Isaiah alluded to, In the first instance, the primary fulfillment would have been the temple in Jerusalem. But the foundation stone really is, I think, pointing forward to the Messiah, isn't it? And perhaps we could relate the foundation stone, the first stone that was laid, could be represented, or representative rather, of the first advent of the Lord Jesus Christ. And the headstone, I think, is representative of the second advent, when the Lord comes back to finish the building, as it were. The building really is symbolic of the people, isn't it? We are the temple of God, living stones. And when Christ comes back at the resurrection, that building, that temple will surely be fulfilled and completed in all its glory. We think of the words of Hebrews as we think about these things, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith. So Zechariah was asked, what do you see as we look back at verses 2 and 3 in the scriptures? We've looked at the temple, now we're going to look at the lampstand. And as we read earlier, that he says, I've looked and behold a candlestick or a lampstand, a wall of gold with a bowl upon the top of it, and his seven lamps thereon, and seven pipes to the seven lamps which were upon the top thereof, and two olive trees by it, one on the right side of the bowl and another upon the left side thereof. So what did he see? Well, this is an artist's impression of what this vision might have looked like. We see two olive trees with two branches coming out towards the lampstand, and two golden pipes from which the olive oil flowed into a bowl, which then connected through further pipes into the lampstand. So whether that's right or not, obviously it's up to interpretation of what we see, but I think that's a pretty good a good illustration of what it might have looked like. Now the lampstand is the menorah, isn't it? The candlestick and the AV are the translations, the better translation being the lampstand, the menorah. And we find there was one in the tabernacle and there was 10 in Solomon's temple. Just a point to note that the national emblem of Israel is also a menorah with flanked either side, the left and the right, two branches of an olive tree, clearly picking up on the theme of Zechariah chapter 4 that we see here. So let's just think about what the menorah was and what we see here, this lampstand here in Zechariah. Now we know the original had to be regularly maintained by the high priest, filled with oil, the wicks were trimmed, etc., and it was maintained daily by the priesthood. The olives, they were harvested and they all pressed out by the people, that they would bring this olive to the priests, who would then burn the oil in the temple. So it was a joint effort by the people and the high priests. Now, normally the fruits, which were the olives, provided the oil. But we see here in this vision that that wasn't the case. We see that there was a direct tap by these two pipes going directly into the olive tree, from which the oil came forth, which was very peculiar, isn't it? And it's clearly supernatural in that sense. Therefore, it is a vision, isn't it? But what I think we're seeing is that this tree, it no longer needs to bear fruit for self-preservation of its kind, because this oil was going to come out forever. This tree will never die. It didn't need fruit. It was going to last forever. And the fact that the branches and the tubes coming out of it were gold, it does speak of immortality, doesn't it? It's tried faith that has been rewarded by the gift of immortality. And that's what I think this vision is speaking about. It's a never-ending supply of oil, and hence a never-ending supply of light. It's the light of God which will never go out. Now, in my margin, the AV, we have a note speaking about seven pipes, or twice seven, as on the screen we've got Young's Literal Translation, where he writes, he said unto me, what art thou seeing? And I say, I have looked, and lo, a candlestick of gold, all of it, and its bowl is on its top, and its seven lamps are upon it, and twice seven pipes are to the lights that are on its top. So what's that telling us? Well, I think it's saying, if we go back to the artist's impression, I don't think it's quite right what's being drawn there. I think what we're being told is that there are seven pipes that go into each lamp on the lampstand. And so rather than seven pipes shown on coming from the bowl, I think there was actually seven times seven pipes coming out. And that's significant, because as we know from scriptures, that seven is the number of completeness. We see on the screen there that in Genesis that God had finished all his work on the seventh day, and he ended his work and he rested and he sanctified the seventh day. because he'd rested. So the work, the 7 days of creation, were completed. So I think we're getting the idea of completeness from scriptures. So what we're seeing with the seven pipes feeding each of the seven lamps, we're getting seven times seven, aren't we? I think as the purpose of God initially was completed on day seven, finally in the kingdom, it will be truly completed. His purpose that was set forth from the beginning would be completed. Hence, I think we're getting seven times seven, a full completeness of the purpose of God depicted by the lamps and the pipes that we see in Zechariah's vision. And just thinking of this, when we think of Revelation chapter 1, when John saw seven stars and seven golden lampstands or candlesticks, and he was told that the seven lampstands which he saw were the representative of the seven ecclesias. So what we're seeing in Revelation is that there were seven lamps per lampstand, as a typical menorah, but then there were seven lampstands. So again, it was seven times seven, the purpose of God being completed. And we know that seven sevens equal 49, and that the 50th year, as we find in Leviticus, was the beginning of a jubilee. And I think that's speaking of the completion of the kingdom age. When in Leviticus it says, "You shall hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land." Except when it comes to the kingdom, liberty will be truly proclaimed throughout all the earth. That's what I think the significance is of all these pipes that numbering seven times seven. And we think about the olive trees, don't we? And we think about Romans chapter 11, where the Apostle Paul likens the wild olive tree being grafted into the good olive tree, speaking of the Gentiles and the Jews. As he said, blindness in part is happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles become in. So I think the two olive trees are actually representative of the Jews and the Gentiles in the kingdom to come. Now, seven eyes keeps appearing throughout this prophecy of Zechariah. We'll just touch upon this for a few moments. Zechariah 3, verse 9, we read of the stone that was put before Joshua was actually laid by Zerubbabel. And it said, "Upon one stone shall be seven eyes, and then there will be an engraving thereof." Now, this could be read that there were seven eyes engraved on the stone, but I rather think it was actually seven eyes. The seven eyes of God will be looking upon the stone, which perhaps the stone itself would have an engraving. We're not told what that was, but it could be holiness to the Lord, as we find on the temple, on the mitre of the priest when he was in the temple. So I think these seven eyes were focused on the stone, and that's clearly focusing on the work of the Lord Jesus Christ. So what are these seven eyes? Well, we read in Zechariah chapter 4, verse 10, they said, "These seven, they are the eyes of the Lord, which run to and fro throughout the whole earth. And we picked up this phrase, "which have walked to and fro through the earth," in Zechariah chapter 1, speaking of the angels amongst them, the myrtle trees. So what we're seeing is it's the eyes of God, it's the angels working in the background to bring about God's purpose. When we look in 2 Chronicles and we get exactly the same expression. The eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong in the behalf of them whose heart is perfect toward him. And the angel of the Lord encampeth around them that love him. So we can take comfort from that. But this idea was picked up again in Revelation. Again, it's a symbol in Zechariah, and it's a symbol again picked up in Revelation, where we see there that in the midst of the throne, John saw four beasts, and in the midst of the elders stood the Lamb as it had been slain. And the Lamb had seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent forth into all the earth. So I think what we're being shown, particularly in Revelation and probably in Zechariah as well, is that previously the work of the angels had been done. These seven eyes were the angels represented going throughout all the earth. But in the time to come, the saints will be the eyes of the Lord, reigning with Christ, teaching the nations, going to and fro throughout the earth to spread God's message and to bring about his purpose. And in fact, it's to complete God's purpose, isn't it? Hence, we get the idea of the seven again, the seven eyes, bringing about the purpose of God and bringing it about to a completion. So what about the plummet? Well, the ESV has this rendering of the scriptures. For whosoever despised the day of small things shall rejoice and shall see the plumb line in the hand of Zerubbabel. We've got depicted there a typical builder's plumb line. Now, in Zechariah, there are two words used to describe plumb line. It's the words for stone and tin. So I think what we've perhaps been shown is that it probably was a tin shaped and would contain stones to give it the weight so that it could hold the line perfectly perpendicular. Now, I'm sure in that as well, in the tin, which came from Britain through the ships of Tarshish, I'm sure there's something even deeper into these words, which we haven't got time to look into for now, but it's worth taking that thought away, brothers and sisters. So before we look at the plumb line, just want to think about a few moments, the measuring line. In chapter 2, verse 1, Zechariah saw a man with a measuring line in his hand. Now, the measuring line, I believe, was used to measure out in the horizontal plane along the ground, to measure out Jerusalem, and particularly, I'm sure, the temple, and particularly the foundation stone, that would be all built according to the purpose of God and would be constructed in decently and in order. But the plumb line was different, wasn't it? That now would be used to ensure that the building, the rest of the building from the foundation, was built perfectly upright. So I think we can get the idea that it wasn't just for a building tool, it was also a spiritual plumb line as well for the people. And we think of these words in Psalm 112, the Hallel Psalms. Psalm 112, the first few verses there, praise ye the Lord. Blessed is the man that feareth the Lord, that delighteth greatly in his commandments. His seed shall be mighty upon earth. The generation of the upright shall be blessed. Wealth and riches shall be in his house, and his righteousness endureth forever. And to the upright there ariseth light. So I think we're getting all these symbols here in Zechariah, the upright measured by the plumb line and the light coming from the lampstand. But as we think about these things, the line was used by the angel, so it was in the hands of an immortal being, the angel, but the plumb line was used in the hands of a mortal Zerubbabel. So I think the lesson we can draw from this is that God brings about circumstances, i.e. the measurement of the line, gives us opportunity to do our part. As Zerubbabel did, he picked up the plumb line, and started building. So there's a lesson in that for us, isn't it, brothers and sisters, that Zechariah said, who hath despised, or God said to Zechariah, who hath despised the day of small things? God's brought circumstances about that the children of Israel, the people, could come back from Babylon into Jerusalem and be part of something bigger than themselves, the building of the temple, etc. But as we said, the people had largely rejected that at this point. But what of our souls? We think of our lives as small lives, and in the grand scheme of things they are, but every little bit helps, doesn't it? How we can help each other. It is a day of small things now. I think Jesus perhaps had the thoughts here of Zechariah and small things when he mentions the parable of the mustard seed. And on the screen there, we've got the first sort of occurrence of Jesus giving a lesson on the mustard seed in Matthew 13. He says, here is a parable. The kingdom of heaven is likened to a grain of mustard seed, which a man took and sowed in his field. And this seed, he said, is the least of all seeds. When it is grown, it is the greatest among herbs. And then later on, he gives the teaching. He says, because of your unbelief, for verily I say unto you, if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, you shall say unto this mountain, remove. And that's exactly what God was saying to the people through Zechariah. This mountain should be laid plain. Jesus continues, remove hence to your yonder place, and it shall remove. The mountain shall remove. And the mountain was removed. And the people did build the temple. And Jesus says, if you have faith as a seed of mustard seed, then nothing shall be impossible unto you. And that's a good encouragement for us, brothers and sisters. It's a day of small things, but we see in the world many things happening when surely soon it will be a day of great things when the Lord returns to the heaven, from heaven to the earth. And we see the people, they said, the time has not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. They weren't aware of the times and the seasons around them. But hopefully, brothers and sisters, we're not like them. We are aware of the times and the seasons in which we live. We see Russia. Many people are writing off Russia, but we ought not to, because this could be the actual start of the fulfillment of God's purpose that the Russian bear might be forced to come down into the land of Israel. So we'll go back to the questions that Zechariah asked. He asks in verse 4 about the lamp and the olive trees. He didn't get a direct answer, so he asks again in verse 11, what are these two olive trees? And again he asks, what be these two olive branches? In verse 12, and finally in verse 14, he gets his answer. He said, the angel said, these are the two anointed ones that stand by the Lord of the whole earth. Literal translation from Young's gives us this rendering, and he said, these are the two sons of the oil who are standing by the Lord of the whole earth. The sons of oil, which I think is a good translation, isn't it? These are the sons of oil. Well, who were there? I think initially, the primary fulfillment, it would be Zerubbabel and Joshua, the governor and the priest, coming back to lead the people to build the temple among seeds of great joy. But the two anointed ones, or the sons of oil, would be Israel after the flesh, the remnant that would be saved at Christ's return, and the Israel of God, the believers. These would be the two sons of oil in the kingdom, Jew and Gentile, and ultimately representing the saints standing by Christ, the Lord of the whole earth. So we see from the timeline that the building was recommenced in the second year of Darius and was finally completed in the second year. It was completed exactly as God had said it would, through the work of Haggai and of Zechariah, and through Zerubbabel rather, and through Joshua, and clearly the seven spirits of God, the angels, working together with them. So we skipped over verse 1. I want to come back to that now, because we see there in verse 1 that the angel talked to Zechariah and he waked him. So clearly, after the previous visions, Zechariah fell asleep. Perhaps he was in awe of what he saw, but now he's wakened as a man that is wakened out of his sleep. And I think that clearly it's a resurrection in type, isn't it? Which is the secondary fulfillment of this prophecy, of this section. But the vision clearly is forward-looking. It's looking forward to the Messiah's return, the foundation stone, the headstone. It's looking forward to the resurrection, when the saints will be made immortal, represented by the gold. And the glorious kingdom will be established, as it was in Zechariah's day, with great shouting and rejoicing. So just to summarize what we've seen, brothers and sisters, I've sort of put all these things together, and I put a paraphrase of verses from the Psalms 118, from Daniel, and from Revelation, and pick up on some of these themes we see in Zechariah, of stone, of the temple, and of light through the lampstand, and put together some verses that I think, for me, sum up what this prophecy is all about, or this vision is all about. So I'll just read them to you. The stone which the builders refused is become the headstone of the corner. This stone, cut out without hands, will smite the image upon his feet and will become a great mountain and fill the whole earth. John saw from this mountain in Revelation that the great city, the holy Jerusalem, having the glory of God, and her light was like unto a stone most precious, a wall great and high, and had 12 gates, 12 foundations, and in them the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. A golden reed was used to measure the city. John saw no temple, but the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are the temple of it. The city had no need of the sun to shine in it, for the glory of God did lighten it, and the Lamb is the light thereof. Them which are saved shall walk in the light of it, and the kings of the earth shall bring their glory and honour unto it. So that's my thoughts, brothers and sisters, and I'll hand back to you. Thanks for listening.